The new movie Life, which opens next Friday, is about a group of astronauts who discover an alien life form and live to regret it.
That's beautiful.
So is Alien Covenant.
Paris, please, open up!
I can't do this anymore.
Life and Alien Covenant were originally scheduled to open on adjacent Fridays. They'll now be a few weeks apart. But that close call has critic Bob Mondello remembering other times rival studios stared each other down and no one blinked.
They are showdowns that didn't need to happen. Earth-snuffing asteroids blown up in the nick of time by nuclear warheads not once, but twice in 1998, with much beeping in Armageddon and slightly higher beeping in Deep Impact.
Three, two, one, now.
That same year, animated insects skittered onto movie screens in Ants.
My father flew away when I was just a larva.
And also in A Bug's Life.
Come on, Francis, you're making the maggots cry.
And all of this just one year after dueling lava flows erupted in Dante's Peak.
That is a pyroclastic cloud.
And Volcano.
I know this sounds crazy, but it almost looks like lava.
Hollywood is not a big town. Everyone knows what everyone else is doing, and movies that cost millions of dollars require many people and many months of development. And still, they end up with Red Planet and Mission to Mars in the year 2000, two romantic comedies about presidential daughters in 2004, and even two animated penguin movies in 2006. Happy Feet with animated dancing penguins.
Yeah, see?
Well, that feels good.
And just a few months later, Surf's Up with animated surfing penguins.
Does anybody in this entire frozen wasteland surf?
You gotta see what I can do, please.
I can actually stand on a board.
You can be happy and everything's gonna be good, and I'm coming with you.
I can't imagine a better day.
One film in each of these pairs will necessarily emerge victorious at the box office, but both will arguably be damaged by their proximity. So why bring them out together? Well, it can sometimes make a perverse kind of sense. Say in 1992, when there were rival movies about the guy who sailed the ocean blue in 1492. Entirely understandable. 500th anniversaries don't come around often. And with everyone figuring there was a chance they'd sail off the end of the earth, it's at least theoretical. A good story.
You are a passionate man, Senor Columbus.
Still, both 1492, Conquest of Paradise, and Christopher Columbus, The Discovery, sank like stones at the box office, even though one had Marlon Brando, the other Gérard Depardieu. Don't ask me which was which. At least there was a reason for them to come out at the same time, as opposed to two presidential kidnapping movies, White House Down and Olympus Has Fallen, or competing high school nerd comedies, Real Genius and Weird Science, or dueling Christ Story musicals. Godspell was still a hit off-Broadway in 1972, and if it had waited a year, it might have been one on screen. But put it in a multiplex opposite big-budget Andrew Lloyd Webber, and it's bound to look puny. Hollywood history is littered with the corpses from other double dust-ups, and sometimes lightning doesn't just strike twice. Three vampire flicks opened in 79, Nosferatu, Dracula, and Love at First Bite, and then there was the year that audiences had to choose between four body-switching comedies. George Burns had an accident that made him, as the title had it, 18 again. Judge Reinhold touched a magic Tibetan skull and switched places with his son in Vice Versa. Dudley Moore took a potion to do the same thing in Like Father, Like Son, and in Big, it was an amusement park wish.
I wish I were big.
That turned a little boy into Tom Hanks.
Sweetheart, it's 7:30, are you up?
I turned into a grown-up, Mom.
Now, there have been times when Hollywood duplication involved a bit of duplicity. When Gone with the Wind was still auditioning Scarlett O'Hara's, the brothers Warner decided to steal MGM's thunder by beating them into theaters with a Confederacy epic of their own. They bought the rights to the Broadway play Jezebel, cast Betty Davis as its vain, self-destructive Southern Belle, and opened it while Gone with the Wind was still shooting.
Bang it on a lady's door. I'm scandalized at you.
How long must we go on like this?
Like what, Chris?
Fighting, fussing all the time, like a couple of children.
Why do you treat me like a child?
Because you act like one, a spoiled one.
You used to say you liked me like that once. You never wanted me to change.
Jezebel won Betty Davis an Oscar, which gave Warner's bragging rights in February of 1939 that pretty much evaporated a few months later. Close on Scarlet and Rhett's heels came two biopics about the guy who ended their way of life, Young Mr. Lincoln and Abe Lincoln in Illinois. Biopics often seem to inspire a herd instinct in Tinseltown. 1960 saw both Oscar Wilde and The Trials of Oscar Wilde coming out, as it were. And more recently, there was a big year for another gay icon, with two stars not only doing Truman Capote impressions, but telling the same stories. Philip Seymour Hoffman in Capote.
Humphrey had just about moved into the hotel bar.
Humphrey Bogart.
Where he and John...
John Huston.
And here's Toby Jones in Infamous.
And I was struggling to write a scene for Bogey.
Bogey? You mean Humphrey Bogart?
Yes. And so John...
Wayne?
Garfield?
Kennedy?
Huston.
Infamous was a tiny indie, while Capote was from a major studio, which explained their overlap. Also true of the competing blonde bombshell biopics about Jean Harlow, one starring Carol Baker and the other Carol Lindley. Two Carols in films released months apart called, believe it or not, Harlow and Harlow. It's like the producers had a death wish. If films are sufficiently different in tone, there won't be audience confusion, even with similar plots. In 1964, shortly after the Cuban Missile Crisis, there were two movies about the start of World War III. Nuclear Annihilation, played straight in Failsafe, and for laughs in Dr. Strangelove.
Hey, what about Major Kong?
There were no reports of moviegoers laughing at the wrong movie. It was about a decade after that that, for the first time in Hollywood history, wiser heads prevailed. Two best-selling novels about burning skyscrapers had been optioned, The Tower by Warner Brothers and The Glass Inferno by 20th Century Fox. Irwin Allen, who'd just made Poseidon Adventure, suggested that they do something that no major studios had ever done at that point, join forces to make...
The Towering Inferno.
Not that there weren't issues. Fox had Steve McQueen under contract, Warner's had Paul Newman, and both insisted on top billing, which was tricky. McQueen also insisted not just that his salary equal Newman's, but that they have the same number of lines. You can almost feel the screenwriters divvying them up.
Phone jacks on every floor.
I'm going to plug into your PA system.
No sweat.
How about your emergency setup?
Battery powered standby system.
All right, now can you take these lines and splice them into our two-way communication fan?
Sure.
And no problem.
No problem.
Riveting, no? Still, audiences got a bigger movie, and Fox and Warner's got the biggest attendance of 1974, roughly the same as for one of the Lord of the Rings movies. So everybody won, proving that it is profitable to not go head-to-head, which is not to suggest that Hollywood has learned that lesson. Witness last year's twin terrible opera singers, Marguerite and Florence Foster Jenkins, and the not two, but seven, seriously, seven Robin Hood movies currently in development, including feminist, punk pop, and dystopian future versions, because the more than 100 previous ones listed in the Internet Movie Database just weren't enough. I'm Bob Mandela.